Hi, I'm Keith Wooden, and welcome to Story Mosaics. Hey, I hope you were with us last Tuesday when we dropped the podcast and Brent Henderson was with us. It was just amazing to hear Brent and have him tell his story. And he and I are really good friends. And so we're going to be symbiotic in this in the future and have opportunities for him to come on here and me to go on to Brent's show as well, just to share a little bit of stories, because that's what we're all about. Somebody has already asked, what is Story Mosaics about? I mean, why the concept of a mosaic when we're talking about story? And it comes back to the very heart and mission of Story Mosaics, and that is this. We believe that everyone has a story. And what makes it special is when you bring your story, and I bring my story, and another brings their story, and everybody's bringing their fractals, if you will, their piece of the story that makes up a much bigger picture. And in the process, we connect, and we get to know one another better, and we create friendships out of it. So we're so excited about being Story Mosaics and not just another story podcast. And that brings us to this whole concept of this. We want you to be very much a part of the Story Mosaic podcast. We're looking for you to get on the website, go there and record your story, whether you're doing it as an audio recording or maybe you're more comfortable writing it out. And here's the thing. When you submit that, we promise we listen to everyone, and we will give you feedback on that story. And now, we can only do it once when we give you feedback there. And it's such a great opportunity for you to find out a little bit more about how to create great stories and become a better storyteller. Okay, so after I left last week and we were talking with Brent, I recognized that I had my own rock bottom story. And so actually we're going to do two stories for one today. And I think it'll be a little bit more fun for you to hear this rock bottom story of my life as well, because mine involves the water as well. And mine involves a river as well. In this case, it's the Gully in West Virginia. I've done the New River, the Upper and Lower New. And then I wanted to challenge myself one step further, and I wanted to go on the Gully. And there is nothing like the Gully in West Virginia. One of the things that's so amazing is to be there when they open these valves to fill the gully with water, and to watch that water shooting out of the dam and filling the gorge with the pent up water, if you will. And if you know anything about the Gully, you know that it's made up of fours and fives in terms of rapids. Now, a lot of debate, because everybody who says that they've shot five rapids may get some argument from others. That was just a four. But Gully is some pretty tough rapids, and you have some great guides that take you down the Gully. And so one of the things that was so neat is our guide for the six of us who were in the raft was this young lady. And I'm talking, she was a tiny woman. She was not more than maybe 110 pounds. And there wasn't anyone in the raft that was under 180, pressing 250s all the way around. But she talked with us, she coached us, and it's not too long after you put your raft in the water that you start hitting these rapids, one after another after another. And she's calling out the commands to for the right side to dig deep, for the left side to paddle backwards so that she can turn it just right. She's sitting on her oar to try to guide it just perfectly and shoot that rapid so we don't go belly up. And she then, when there's a little bit of a lull, she gives us some instructions. You'd think that she would have given these instructions before we got into the raft, but there's a few more because we're going to go further down the river and it's going to get more challenging. And one of the things that she tells us is, hey, if you get thrown out of the raft, just come up to the surface. Every raft that's in the water at that point will be there to try to get you. You don't have to try to make it back to your raft. Every raft, and every guide goes all hands on deck, so to speak, and they all come after you. And so there's a certain comfort level of knowing that everybody's pulling together. We had a special treat on Hearth, so we're about a third of the way down the gully when she says, well, and I'm sure you've noticed that, well, I'm wearing a bracelet around my ankle, and I immediately thought some kind of decoration or some kind of bracelet that she had. No, it was her bracelet that said she was on work release. And she said, now, when I get done here, I go back and I spend my time there at the house, and I have to make sure that I'm accountable for all my time. But yeah, I did some bad things. And she told the story, and I'm sitting here thinking, hey, this is my guide in the river. I am entrusting my life to her, and she's got a checkered past. Yeah, she was a great guide. One of the things, though, she did was, and a lot of the boats do this, but they kind of ascertain the skill level of those people who have their oars in the water, so to speak. And if you've got a good group and you're working together, she tells you, okay, at this next rapid, we're going to go through it. We're going to turn around. We're going to paddle as hard as we can right up to the edge of the rapid, and we are going to surf the rapid. Now, let me explain to you what that means, because it's kind of fun to get a picture of it. But as the rapid comes over the rock, it creates this gully, if you will, right down in the water. And then it surges back up, and it also creates an opportunity just to kind of surf that edge. Here's the problem. Go too far, the front of your boat gets caught in the down surge, and everybody flips. And when I say flip, it's not a mild thing. The person in the back, in this case, our guide, would fly over our heads and land somewhere upstream and be forced into going through this rapid with feet down, butt down on the water, and going through it with no raft. All of us would leave the boat at that point. And so we were very sensitive and very conscious of, she said, we want you to hear every command I give you, because it's so imperative that we don't go too fast. But if we go too slow, we're going to be spit out. And that's not good either, because it's not a comfortable situation to be in. So here we go. We come through the rapids. We turn around, we row with all of our might, and she's screaming at us over the roar of that rapid, what to do and how to row, and we're just digging in our paddles and digging in our paddles and digging in our paddles, and then all of a sudden, we're just in it. We are in this perfect position where we are surfing the rapid. It's one of the most exhilarating things you could ever imagine. Oh, I forgot to tell you. She told us one other little cue. She told us that if, for any reason, we get flipped, I need you to do something. I need you to let yourself be pulled to the bottom of the rapid and let the rapid spit you out. I just want you to let that sink in. Let yourself be pulled to the bottom of the rapid and let the rapid spit you out. She reviewed it a couple of times and said, do you get that? Do you get that? And we all nodded, but none of us knew what it would feel like. And so we're paddling into it, and it's such an amazing moment for us when all of a sudden we just got a little bit wonky and the front of the raft got caught in the vortex of the water coming down over the rock, and it caught us and flipped the raft. She went flying right over our heads. She must have been thrown about 15 feet high and about 30 feet going far for completely upstream and coming back down at us. The rest of us were thrown into this. I had no consciousness of where anybody else was at that moment. What I did know was this. I was struggling with everything I had to get back up. And nobody had warned us, so nobody said, okay, one, two, three, get a big breath. No, we went down in such a moment that none of us had gotten a big, deep breath before we went down there. And probably one of my deepest fears is the fear of drowning, of not being able to breathe. And here I am struggling to get back up to the top, and tons of water are crashing down on my head. I don't know whether you know this or not, but 1 cubic yard of water weighs 1 ton. So every moment there were several tons crashing down on us. I lost complete consciousness of the raft. I lost complete consciousness of everyone around me, and I recognized I was not making any headway. And all of a sudden, at that moment, I could not breathe, and I could not hold it any longer. I recognized that my next breath was going to be a breath full of the river water. I just gave up. I went down, and I did exactly what she wanted us to do. But in the meantime, I had fought for so long against the river. The river pounded me into the bottom, just bruised me to pieces against a flat rock that was at the bottom of the pan there. And then all of a sudden, it just took me and spit me out downstream about 20 yards. And as soon as my head came above water, the most amazing thing happened. Everyone there, all of the guides had pointed their boats in towards the center, and they had these little bags, these bags with kind of a sand in them and then a rope that was attached to their wrists. And they threw those bags at us, and each one, every one of us that was in that boat was getting pelted in the head with these bags, but they were our lifeline to safety. I grabbed mine and somebody pulled me over. I didn't know who they were. I didn't care who they were. I didn't care that they weren't my guide, that they weren't on my raft. All I cared was that they were my lifeline. It was one of the most amazing moments. They pulled me up into the boat, grabbed the life preserver, pulled me back up into the boat, and we went downstream a little ways, and they finally got us back into the raft, and she debriefed us on what had happened. Here's the thing. I had a rock bottom experience there too. I've had a lot of rock bottom experiences in my life. And through the course of Story Mosaics, you're going to hear quite a few of those, because some of them were, well, they were turning points, transformation points. And the fact is, there's a verse that I always come back to in the Bible that reminds me that rock bottom's not so bad. It's in James chapter 1, and it's verses 2, 3, 4, and it says this. This is from the Message. It's called Faith Under Pressure. Consider it a sheer gift, my friends, when tests and challenges come at you from every side. Can I just do my own Keith Wooden paraphrase of that? Consider it a sheer gift, friends, when tests and challenges come at you from every side. Because that's rock bottom. But you know that under pressure, your faith life is forced into the open and shows its true colors. So don't try to get out of anything prematurely. Let it do its work so you become mature, well-developed, not deficient in any way. You see, hitting rock bottom can be a gift. Can be an extraordinary gift in our lives. And sometimes that's what we need, to force our faith life out in the open. Hey, I thought I'd just tag team off of Brent there and get a little bit of my story in there as well, of a rock bottom story. But I want to tell you another story here today. So you're getting 2 for 1, okay? But this was a story that appeared in Chicken Soup for the Bride's Soul, and it's a great story, one that I wrote for them, and I mentioned to you that I've written scripts for screenplays, one for Sundance that was an award winner for Sundance. I've had the opportunity to write some plays as a scriptwriter for plays as well. And then I've had the privilege of being a columnist for Focus on the Family for a period of time. And then I also had the privilege of writing for Chicken Soup for the Soul. And in this case, Chicken Soup for the Bride's Soul. And this one is a little story. It's not long. But I think it has something that we can gather something from. And here's what we're going to do. Because I don't want to be detracting from the story as I tell it today. But when I come back next Tuesday, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this story apart so that you can understand a little bit better what makes a good story. And evidently this one was good enough for publishing and being sold several million copies around the world. It's a story of a couple, and I mentioned to you that I was a pastor for a period of time, and one of the things that I did while I was a pastor is that I did weddings, and one of the byproducts of doing weddings is that I had the opportunity to spend some time with couples in premarital counseling. The fact is, I wouldn't perform their wedding unless they spent 6 hours with me in premarital counseling. And so when Shane and Melissa came to me and said, hey, we would like you to marry us, I was so excited. I knew them from the community in Pendleton, and I was very excited about being a part of their wedding. But I was also pretty excited about spending some time with them and getting to know them better. One part of it was that I needed to get a little bit of a family history. But there was something just kind of nagging away. Have you ever seen a couple and you wonder, how did they get together? I mean, what was it that attracted them to one another? Well, that was kind of my experience with Shane and Melissa. They were two phenomenal people, and they would make a great couple. But I wondered, what did she see in him, and what did he see in her? She was a bright, affable person. She was very quick with a wit, and she didn't pull any punches. And Shane was a teddy bear of a guy, and what a softy. And all she had to do was give him that look, and he just would melt. But also, all he had to do was give her that look, and she melted as well. And so I started looking for what was it that was their lives, and what were they drawn to in one another? Well, I mentioned to you that there was a time when we got some family history on them. And that family history was a little bit about the family of origins and what that was like. But I have to admit, I was using it for something else. I wanted to find out a little bit more about them in depth. They told me they were from Pendleton, Indiana, and I know that many of you will not know where Pendleton, Indiana is, but it's kind of a Mayberry throwback, okay? Especially when they were growing up in it. The summer were those summers where kids found their opportunities to play in the backyards of individuals' homes throughout the community. They would play football or softball or baseball, all kinds of different things. Soccer had not yet caught on, but yeah, they'd kick the ball around in some pickup games of basketball. Over the summer, the kids would leave the house right after cartoons in the morning, and they weren't expected to come home until dinner time. And then oftentimes right after dinner, they were back on the streets, hanging around on the courts and talking as well. And one of the things about that time was that you've got to know one another really, really well. You'd spend that lunchtime with them, and you'd have bologna because the person's mom who you were at that particular day was responsible for your lunch. So you got bologna, and if you were lucky, it was tomato season. You got a little bit of a tomato, or maybe you got a boiled hot dog that had burst and looked like it needed stitches to hold itself back together, or maybe a PBJ, or maybe some, if you were lucky, some of Grandma Cook's noodles. But those were the times when you didn't have the preoccupation of games and stuff like that. I'm talking about electronic games to be distracted. One of the things, though, was that Shane was a natural athlete. He played every sport, and he played them well, and especially baseball. And so when the pickup games in baseball took place, there was Shane playing second base, and he was good. But there was something else that was amazing about that moment as well. You see, there was another individual there. His name was Ryan. Ryan wasn't playing, but he was there every day, whether it was the pickup basketball game or the pickup baseball game or the football game. He was there, and He was confined to a wheelchair. He had a severe case of muscular dystrophy. Now, it has a special name, but I'm simplifying it there. His limbs were underdeveloped, and his muscle tone was lacking almost completely. His feet turned awkwardly in, and his knees bumped together, and his hands were contorted in such a way that he couldn't do anything but just grab a hold of that joystick that allowed his motorized wheelchair to be directed where he wanted it to be. But he was there, and he called every game. What was neat about this is that at the end of every game, Shane walked over, and he walked Ryan home. And they would relive every one of those moments in the game. And according to Ryan, Shane was always the hero. There was something else, though, that took place is that they became fast friends. Not just in that third grade time frame, but all the way up to college. And it came time for Ryan to go to college, and Shane wasn't going to college. Shane was going to go ahead and take a job there in Pendleton and become a part of the community in that way. But when Ryan got down to IU, he found that his caregiver was totally inept and could not take care of him. And Shane was a big enough guy to be able to lift Ryan from his wheelchair and be able to position him, whether it was for bed or for any of his private needs. Shane served him in every way. And so Ryan's parents came and made a request of Shane. They knew he wasn't going to college down at IU, but would he be willing to go down and be Ryan's caregiver at Indiana University? Shane said, yes, of course. And all of a sudden, I started to grab that thread that began to unravel this story of this young man and what this woman saw in him. Fast forward to the time when we're getting ready to get married. They're getting ready to get married. And there's a few little details that I needed to attend to. And so I said, I needed to know who the best man would be. And Shane looked at me like, do you not understand? And he said, well, Ryan, of course. And I said, well, maybe you don't understand there's certain responsibilities that Ryan will need to take care of. And I'm just not. And he interrupted me and he said, he'll be fine. He'll be just fine. We got a little bit closer and we talked about how the bridesmaids would come in, and sometimes bridesmaids are ushered in, and sometimes they stand on the platform with the couple, and all of these different things. And at each corner, I felt like I was making a judgment and I was experiencing a prejudice against Ryan's disabilities. And I realized that, man, Ryan wasn't the one with the disability. I was. More of a prejudice. When we got to the time where Ryan would usher in his bridesmaid, he maneuvered the chair right down the aisle, turned it around, and she gently put her hand in his arm, and they made their way down the rest to the head of the aisle. Not a dry eye in the place. One of the most moving moments that I've ever seen in a wedding. But there was one more thing to be done. You see, the best man, and that is what Ryan was, needed to sign the marriage license. And I went to Shane once again, and I said, Shane, I need a signature on this, and who's going to sign this marriage license? And again, he looked at me and he said, well, Ryan, of course. And I interrupted him and I said, but how? He can't write. There's no way he can. He took the marriage license from me and he walked over to Ryan. He wedged a pen in Ryan's contorted fingers. And then he held the license up to the end of that pen. And I recognized I was about to experience a sacred moment. You see, they had done this dance many, many times throughout their history, and they had signed many, many papers. Ryan's fingers moved almost imperceptibly as Shane moved the paper in a perfect, perfect script of Ryan's name. All of a sudden, I realized what Melissa saw in him. You know what? A lot of people read the Bible, and it says in the Bible that the two will become one flesh. And there's been a lot of twisted ideas about what that meant. Some people reducing the one flesh to only the sexual act and that making two people one. I have to tell you that Ryan and Shane were one flesh, though they would never be married. What they understood was how two hearts and two lives and two minds and two wills could work and join themselves to become a more powerful force. I called Shane up just before I've recorded this and said, "Hey, Shane, I'm going to do a podcast, and I asked your permission when I wrote about it, but I want to ask your permission again." And he said, "Oh, I'd be so honored. And can you tell us when the podcast airs? Hey, Shane, I'll give you a buzz and let you know. And by the way, Melissa, you did well. You did well." Sometimes we recognize that these stories, they tie us together in ways that we cannot imagine. And this is one of those stories on Story Mosaic today. Thank you for joining us.